The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Welcome, everybody, to this Sunday night in June. My name's Doug McGill. I'm from Rochester. I drove up to give the Dharma talk tonight. I run a meditation center in Rochester called the Rochester Meditation Center. RochesterMeditation.org, and you're all very warmly invited to come down anytime. And please don't wait until you're sick and have to make a trip to the Mayo Clinic, which is how most people end up finding us. They're on their way to Rochester and they Google Rochester and meditation, and next thing you know, they're in the meditation hall. I've been coming here to Common Ground for about 15 years, while it was still in Mark and Wynn's house a few blocks from here. Very briefly, just so you know my background, I did grow up in Minnesota. I grew up in Rochester, actually. I went to college out in Portland, Oregon. After college, I became a journalist, and I was a journalist for about 30 years. First with the New York Times in New York, then I worked as a freelancer in Tokyo for a number of years. Then I joined Bloomberg News, and I worked for them all over the world, Tokyo, London, and Hong Kong. And I moved back to Rochester in 2000. I've been meditating since my early 20s when I started working as a journalist back then, and I started meditating just as a stress reliever. Maybe it was in the 1990s I started getting more serious about it, and when I moved back to Rochester in 2000, there were some family reasons for that, but in 2004, I started going really deep and opened the meditation center at that time, and we've been going ever since. So that's just a little bit of background on me. And then for the talk tonight, the title of the talk is Don't Worry, Be Empty. And I came across that title because the first title that came to my mind was Pain is the Path. But I didn't think I could get too many people to come for that talk. But I got you now. So don't worry, be empty. I'm sure that you know that emptiness is a really central idea and, more importantly, practice in Buddhism. And the reason it is because it's the most potent antidote for suffering, what the Buddha called suffering, dukkha. This is emptiness as a practice is the most potent antidote for suffering. Suffering meaning everything from the full-blown suffering that we have, addiction, depression, grief, mania, everything at that severe end, all the way back to just the normal sense we have in daily life that things could be better. God darn it. Most of us, I think, certainly myself, if we were to really be honest in any given moment, there's a tape in our mind that's saying that's what's happening right now isn't really good enough and needs to be better. And, if we have anything going on in our body in the way of an ache or an illness or anything going on in our mind, which is pretty much a given, you know, as a distraction or a problem, then the mind will say, this is the problem. And this needs to be better, and it seems quite obvious that it does need to be better. By the way, it doesn't necessarily mean that it is a problem, but it certainly seems like it is, and it seems obvious that it is. So actually, tonight's sharing is really about a way to see how we habitually tell ourselves stories about our experience that seem quite obvious, but in fact, when we really pay attention with our awareness, our consciousness, the seriousness or the urgency, even the pain of the problem, whether it's mental or physical, starts to dissolve. And this is the process of and the practice of emptiness. So I just wanted to share a few stories tonight from the Buddhist lore, from maybe two or three different practitioners and teachers, including the Buddha. And I'll share a few stories of how I practice with emptiness. And I brought along a show and tell item or two. And then let's leave some time so that we can share with each other what you may already be doing as emptiness practices, although you may not have recognized it as such, because guaranteed you are. If you got to a point in life where you're settled enough and brought a modicum of sanity and happiness to your life, you're already doing emptiness practice. There's no other way to survive this life than to be doing emptiness practice. And so it's super helpful. It has been for me, and it's super helpful for many people to recognize that, hey, things that you're already doing can be recognized as healthy, and the recognition will help you to give those activities a greater place in your life. And then with the extra teachings that you get from the Dhamma, you know, they can go deeper and deeper, possibly all the way. In fact, surely all the way in many areas of life. So let me start by noticing or noting that if you go to the website of Common Ground, or if you look at the sign of Common Ground out there on 26th, you see two footprints. That's an image of emptiness. And for many years, for several hundred years after the Buddha died, the tradition was to never show the Buddha as a person. So the images that we have today of the Buddha sitting in a meditating posture with his half smile, that didn't come along for hundreds of years until after his death, at least not on a widespread scale. Instead, artists would represent the Buddha with images of emptiness, such as the footprints. Or another very popular one, which you can see in stone relief sculptures all the way up until the early 100 years of the Christian era, 200, 300, 400 AD in India, there would be pictures of an empty chair, often with the Bodhi tree behind it, and then with various kind of gods and goddesses of, you know, heavenly figures kind of floating around the empty chair. And so this little bookmark that I sent around is a little calling card for the Rochester Meditation Center, and there's the empty chair. And on the mantelpiece, it's my old home. My home is the living room has been turned into a meditation hall, and right there on the mantelpiece is a sculpture of Kuan Yin, a Buddhist goddess of compassion, and right next to her is a little wooden empty chair representing the Buddha as he was depicted for hundreds of years. So it's a metaphor, but the fact that so many artists used it and still use it, the lotus is another symbol of the Buddha. Sort of like, you know, there's an emptiness at the center of a lotus as well. It's when we reflect in this way, we start to do emptiness practice. And it's good for us to enjoy bringing up these super healthy, super potent archetypal images, because they activate the actual experience of emptiness within us. So if you're feeling that in certain ways, it's because we're just bringing to consciousness these potent catalysts of liberation, freedom. So as I mentioned, I really want to talk about emptiness mostly as a practice, and to also have a little bit of fun, a little bit of improvisation, and especially customization. So as I throw out these little stories and anecdotes and images, I hope that you will see what it might spark for you, and bring that experience forward more so that you can, you know, encourage it within yourself and make emptiness practice a more conscious process. So although we do focus the practice element of emptiness, it's unavoidable that there is a kind of a germ of an idea. In other words, emptiness as an idea. The Buddha did teach emptiness as an idea hundreds of years after he passed away, especially in the later phases of Buddhism. And during the so-called Mahayana period, there were many great geniuses and scholars and spiritual virtuosi who took this concept of emptiness and expanded it vastly. In the Buddha's own time and in the Theravada tradition that this Insight Meditation Center is based on, emptiness is very central, and it's very there's a good amount of emphasis on it because of its centrality. But it's a lot simpler, and in that sense, a lot easier to use when we go back to the root texts of this branch of Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, which is literally the verbatim teachings of the Buddha as gathered in the Pali scripture. So there is a short sutta on emptiness called the Sunya Sutta, the Emptiness Sutta. And it goes like this. So this is the Buddha telling us what is the idea of emptiness. And it's very short. It goes like this. So then Venerable Ananda went to the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, "It is said that the world is empty." "The world is empty, Lord. In what respect is it said that the world is empty?" Then the Buddha answered, "Insofar as it is empty of a self or of anything pertaining to a self, thus it is said, Ananda, that the world is empty." So in the guided meditation, this is why I highlighted, you know, that moment when we're sitting and then we can kind of suddenly get that realization. I was like, oh my God, I'm not really breathing. I'm being breathed. You know what I'm saying? There's that sense of like, holy smokes, I guess I am alive because livingness is working through me. You know, like just as the waves in the ocean go in and out, the breath is going in and out of us. And you can, it's a kind of a startling realization. And then that's emptiness practice, because it satisfies this condition that suddenly you realize there's nobody here doing it. It's just happening. That's emptiness right there. Let me make a little commentary note on this, what I just said, which is that as you read Dharma books and as you listen to Dharma teachers, it's frequently said how complicated emptiness is. It's a difficult concept, they say. Teachers say it's difficult. And there certainly are ways that it's taught that have a lot of words. Interdependent origination is one of the core doctrines of the Buddha taught by himself during his lifetime, and that can get pretty abstract sounding. But I just want to stress, and this talk is really about ways that we can connect immediately with emptiness practice. And also, as I mentioned, recognize that we've already done it in our lives many times. And this is just by way of saying, oh, that's that. When you notice that, that's the real stuff. Don't ignore it. Go back to it and build up from it. And the Buddha did go on a little longer here. He said, insofar as it is empty of itself or anything pertaining to a self. Thus it is said in the end that the world is empty. And what is empty of a self or of anything pertaining to a self? Then he goes on to say, the I is empty of a self or anything pertaining to a self. And then he goes on to say, the ear is empty, the nose is empty, the tongue is empty, the body is empty, and so on. In other words, he goes on in this sutta to break down each of the component parts of our life experience. And just as we notice that there's really nobody there doing the breathing, there's really nobody there doing the seeing, there's nobody there doing the hearing, there's nobody doing the tasting, the smelling, or the thinking. Even though we say, I will be thinking about such and such a thing, isn't it more our practice? And here again, I'm just inviting you and me and everybody to just like, have you ever noticed that there's a lot of thinking that goes on in your mind that you're not really in control of? Right? You're trying to fall asleep and you can't because the thoughts are too loud and too plentiful and too noisy and too speedy, you know? And they're just doing that. Why? Because it's nature is happening that way right now. That's the way nature is happening right now. You're having a storm of thoughts. And that's the way it is right now. So there are many of these suttas where the Buddha expands on the practice of emptiness. And several of them are actually called, you know, like there's the greater discourse on emptiness, the lesser discourse on emptiness. My favorite one, and the one that I've used as a kind of a koan, meaning over the years, the full meaning of it hasn't been apparent to me, but I recognized it early on as having a kind of quality that I needed to understand, that I needed to understand what was being said. And over the years, its meaning as a practice has unfolded to me to a degree that's been really helpful. And this is the story of the Bahiya Sutta. Now, one reason I love this sutta so much is there's a wonderful story that goes with it. It's not just a raw kind of philosophical teaching, but it talks about this spiritual teacher who was alive at the time of the Buddha called Bahiya. And he of the bark cloth, it said. So I guess he wore bark cloth. And he had his whole group around him, and he was revered, and he was respected, and he had a lot of followers. But inside his heart, he knew he was not enlightened. He was not liberated. He was tortured. So he got to a point where he felt quite hypocritical and quite conflicted that all these people were coming to him for answers, but he didn't have the answer for himself. And so he cried out one night, and one of these little heavenly spirits called devas came down to him and said, Bahiya, you're right. You're not enlightened. You're not even on the right path. You know? And Bahiya just got this just big jolt of urgency, like, oh my God, here's the deva telling me I'm not even on the right path. He was seized with this super intense urgency, like, I have to get enlightened right now. And in some kind of a mysterious fashion, he literally just got up and the deva told him that there was one person nearby, the Buddha, who was enlightened and who could tell Bahiya. So Bahiya just got up and he started running for 3 days, didn't sleep, just ran day and night to get to the Buddha. And he finally found the Buddha, and the Buddha was on his morning's alms round. And so here comes Bahiya, exhausted, and he says to the Buddha, I need to get enlightened right now. And the Buddha said, can't you see I'm on my morning alms round? You'll have to come back later. But Bahiya was in this state, you know. No, you don't understand. I might die soon. I have this feeling, this overwhelming, urgent feeling. I just need to be enlightened. And the Buddha put him off a second time. And then you know how these stories go. The third time's a charm, right? So at this point, he's literally begging and tears are streaming down his face. So the Buddha says, okay, I'll tell you how to get enlightened right now. So can you see why I like this sutta? Anybody want to get enlightened right now? Because the Buddha gave him the instructions on how to get enlightened right now. Like, right now. So when I read the sutta, like, I was like, holy smokes. I'm really going to pay attention to these next few lines. Because I super want that. And it goes like this. So the Buddha finally relents, he puts down his food bowl and he gives him the teaching. It's like this. He says, Bahia, this is how you should train yourself. In the seen is only the seeing. In the heard is only the hearing. In every sense, there is only the sensing. In every thought is only the thinking. When for you, the seen is only the seeing, in the heard is only the hearing, in the sense there is only the sensing, in every thought is only the thinking. Then, Bahia, there is no you in connection with the sensing or the thinking. When there is no you in connection with the sensing or the thinking, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder, nor between the two. This is the end of suffering. And as the story goes, Bahia instantly got enlightened and started his way home. And he reports from the audience, how's it going? I see a light over in this corner. Oh, everywhere. So the way it worked for me and is still working for me is the meaning of this over a period of years is like I get a little bit more. I get a little bit more. And I haven't had any big Shazam experience, but I have had a gradual enlightening or something like that, because I have found this to be extremely practical in lots of daily life situations. Over time, I've worked it that way. And the other thing about this sutta is, once you read it and you read the rest of the suttas, this type of phraseology comes up frequently. So it's right there in the Bahia Sutta, in the seen is only the seeing, in the heard there is only the hearing, and this whole thing is repeated a number of times throughout the suttas. So it's not, Bahia is not the only one who got this teaching. One of the other people in the stories who got this teaching was the Buddha's own son, which again, in a sense, elevates and heightens the importance of the teaching, that the Buddha would give it to his own son, who at the age of 21 got enlightened, according to the stories. So what exactly does this mean, you know? And what's potent about it? And why is it liberating? And then can we throw in a few stories, other types of stories that help make it more like readily understandable to us, to as living beings who may not have, probably have not really looked at our own life experience with this particular set of spectacles before. Like the first time you hear these words, I didn't really get it. You see what I mean? So how can we make it more tangible, more realistic, more available? So what I did to prepare this talk was I just tried to like settle down and sit down and think, okay, if I were going to really simplify it, how would I describe the practice of emptiness as I work it myself, in my daily life? And let me, if I may, give you first a kind of meta description of it, and then let me give you an example from my own life where I did apply it and have applied it with in a way that has really helped me. And when I do this kind of meta description, of the practice of emptiness, this is not just coming from me. This is also a kind of a distillation of teachings that I've gotten both from Buddhist meditation and other forms of meditation that I've done over the years. So they're quite, these, I've boiled it down to two steps, and it's really a condensation of the teachings themselves. And so the first step is to shift attention from objects to awareness. What does that mean, and how do you do it? So this is just basically to say that most of the time, meaning until we start to meditate, quite often 99.9% of the time, or 98 or 97% of the time, all of our perceptions are going outward, right? So perceptions we're talking about. So seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, and thinking is usually going out into the world to see objects, to hear objects, meaning the objects of sounds, to taste cake and ice cream, to smell flowers and things, and to touch things. And this is the way the world comes to us, is through our perceptions, right? And I say the world comes to us, but actually our perception is going out to grab those things. That's what's really happening. And then they come back with them, so to speak. But what the Buddha is saying to Bahia is, Bahia, turn that arrow of perception, which is normally going this way, and do a 180, so that you are looking back at your own awareness, your own consciousness. Again, don't know where you are on the path. When you first hear this, when I first hear this, it's like, what the hell does that mean? You know, like, what? I'm supposed to look at my awareness? What's that? Or like, where is my awareness? Where's my consciousness? It's not so, that's a little tricky at first, I think. It was for me. It still is in some cases. But this is the instruction. It's like, look back and see that in the seen is only, in the seen is only the seeing, okay? In the heard is only the hearing. And keep your attention there. So this is a practice. And in fact, it's like when we sit down to do our meditation, right? What's the first thing we did tonight? And what's the first thing you do? Isn't there a tangible sense of awareness is returning home, right? It's like coming back. We've all felt that, right? So that's it. But then the meditation, it continues on, is to keep it there and to notice what we can notice about how life is happening to us. Because what's happening to us most of the time is we're creating suffering for ourselves. Yuck! That's what we want to see with brilliant clarity so we can stop doing it. So that's what meditation is. It's like turn those arrows around, look back in, but don't stop there. Once you've got calm and you're settled and you're enjoying that, then do a deep investigation to see why in the heck we keep creating stress and suffering for ourselves. What's going on in here that keeps us in this perpetual state of things could be better and I need to go out and get something to make it better? Because that's the thing we're caught in. So that's the first step, is to shift attention from objects to awareness. Okay, and the second step, and this is where things get really interesting and kind of right down to the nitty-gritty. So I summarized this step with the words, ignore the mind at all times. Hey, I have to tell you, have you heard of a famous Theravadan monk called Ajahn Sumedho? So he's a monk in this tradition, the Theravada tradition, and he was raised, or he came up as a monk in the Thai forest tradition. I think he's originally from the United States. Anyway, he's not Thai, but he went over and he ordained with this great Theravadan meditation master, Ajahn Chah, in the Thai forest. And Ajahn Sumedho eventually became the abbot of a major Theravadan monastery in England, and he's taught all over the world. He's now, I think, he's pushing 80. He recently retired, but in the kind of retirement interview, he came to Spirit Rock Meditation Center, and another meditation teacher Philip Moffat interviewed him, and he asked Ajahn Sumedho, after all of these years of practicing and teaching meditation, and having attained all that you've attained, could you distill all of your understanding into one sentence? He asked him that. Yeah, and Ajahn Sumedho said, yes, I can. Well, Philip Moffat said, what? What is it? What's your great understanding? Ajahn Sumedho said, don't believe anything the mind says. That's it. That's why I say ignore the mind at all times. At least enough so that you can put a thought before you and either decide whether you're going to kind of go with that thought and what the statement that it's making about reality, or whether you're just going to let it go. But for the practice of emptiness, it's actually a good idea to ignore all thoughts for this practice. Because the thing about thoughts is that they are not, that they come subsequent to actual experience. Our actual raw experience is not thought or thinking. Our actual raw, if you take a jump in the ocean, you thinking about it, or are you just enjoying it? Taking a shower, for that matter. Going out into the sunlight. What role does thought have to do with that? Not much. It comes along later if you write a poem, or you remember it later. And of course, the gap between experience and thinking is sometimes quite short, very almost, you know, infinitely small, almost, you know. Like if I see my if I'm looking at my hand, like this is the scene, okay? The scene right now is, I'm saying, is my hand. But if I really look at that with the meditative mind, I'm not seeing a hand. There's just seeing is happening. Are you with me? Seeing is happening. Now, thought very quickly says that's a hand. Do you see what I'm saying? Now, what's interesting is, you know, thought can be wrong. While I wasn't looking, someone could put up a little mannequin of my hand, and I'd, oh, that's my hand. But no, my thought would be mistaken. That's just a mannequin hand, you know? So the point is that basically thought is always coming along. It's panting after actual experience, you know, coming along way behind. But then it has the audacity and the arrogance, thought does, to label and judge experience. And it's even so arrogant as to say eventually that what we think is experience, that is our life. Descartes said, I think, therefore I am. That's the opposite of meditative insight. That's the absolute opposite, to say that my thought is my reality. So when I say ignore the mind at all times, you know, it's like to just, what I wrote here was, at the beginning, ignore the mind that says emptiness is negative, difficult, and complex. So for instance, with emptiness practice, the first thing the mind tends to do is to say, emptiness, I'm not interested because it's nothing. Ugh. You know? It's like, who cares about emptiness? I want something. Right? That's what the mind says. And, you know, emptiness, so here's the other thing about the dastardly mind. And I mean that. That sounds like Rocky and Bullwinkle, but anyway, it is dastardly because the mind, if you look at it, is constantly trying to persuade us that our life is not our life, that our real life is thinking. And so it's always trying to keep us in thought rather than what our actual life is. And it starts, and it's beginning and in the middle and after experience. So this very first thing is like, it'll judge the thought of emptiness as unworthy, and so we never even get close to it. Now, as an antidote to that, because I like to try to be playful with this and, you know, to apply it to my own life. So I made up a list of good empty things, because I don't buy it that my mind says that emptiness is not good. So I bought this bowl a long time ago. And so this is a big bowl made out of ash. And isn't it beautiful? Isn't it a gorgeous bowl? I love it. And one way that we might look at the bowl is to see the round form. But what I want to suggest is that an equally, in fact, far more potent way to look at the bowl is to put our attention on the emptiness as opposed to the form. So this is emptiness practice right there. Just to do that. Just to do that and see what happens. It's emptiness practice to just pay attention to the space. And to just notice. What do you notice? If you literally, it feels like the first time you're riding a bike, it's like, what's that guy asking me to do? Look into empty, you know, just like, what? But still, go ahead and do it, you know, because that's the practice. What comes to mind, or what do you feel when you see this bowl as the emptiness and not the form? So how many visitors go to see the Grand Canyon every year? It's more than 1 million. What are we going to see when we see the Grand Canyon? Emptiness. I've been there. We're just staring into emptiness. That's it. Millions of people go there because we're attracted to emptiness. Let's acknowledge that and revel in it. It's so fantastically beautiful. And do you feel a sense of, oh my God, that's right. Now, if you can shift that and find the Grand Canyon in yourself, that's meditation. That's emptiness practice. And there is a Grand Canyon in every single one of ourselves, and it's a lot bigger than the Grand Canyon. It really is. And it's just a matter of trying it and seeing and, like, what would that be like? And just to even start to move that way myself, I can feel my posture start to change to accommodate the space that I'm feeling by just bringing this to mind. Good empty things. That's a list that sounds like a poem. Bubbles, balloons, ballrooms, nooks and crannies, caves and caverns, footprints, blimps and zeppelins, wooden bowls, spoons, the large intestine. It feels great when it's empty. Have you noticed? Cupped hands, an open heart, an open mind, silence, stillness, deserts, canyons, landscapes, seascapes, the sky, energy, matter. Every scientist will tell you that an atom is like, well, I actually went and looked it up once. It's point, and then put 13 nines after the point, percent empty. And the rest is energy. Matter doesn't even exist the way we think it does. Mysteries, they're empty. Questions, wombs, W-O-M-B-S, outer space. Inner space. So it's just really, you know, I start to get limbered up. Like, I kind of warm up to emptiness when I read that list to myself or think about it. I call that emptiness practice. Think about the qualities of emptiness. Again, you know, in the Dzogchen Tibetan practice, they have a practice called sky gazing. I've done a lot of sky gazing on retreating. But in sky gazing, you're just looking up. You're just looking up, maybe for hours at a time, looking at the sky. And when you do that long enough, you start to find the sky in yourself. And it starts to get into you. It starts to get into your nooks and crannies. it starts to get into your caves and caverns. How many of us have caves and caverns that have been, that are in need of clear, luminous light? I know I do. And a lot of spelunking is required as well in my channels, which are another empty thing, tubes and tunnels. So anyway, just think about the qualities of, like when you look, what's the quality of that emptiness up there? It's luminous, isn't it? How beautiful is the sky, the empty sky? It's luminous and spacious and clear. It's non-distorting. What's there you see. Still and silent. And another thing about emptiness, invulnerable. If you can feel that your own body is empty through emptiness practice, you will know that your true body is invulnerable. And that's probably another whole Dharma talk. It's a whole practice in itself. But if you do sky gazing a lot, you do start to feel that your body is spacious and clear like the sky. And then you start to recognize that, my gosh, it's also my thoughts are like that. My emotions are like that. My body is experienced like that. And then the recognition comes that there's an invulnerability to this experience here that's no different from the one up there. When I say invulnerable, if you throw red paint in the sky, does anything stick? If a lightning bolt goes through the sky, does the sky care? You know, we can know our bodies in the same way and our emotions. Not to mention just the capacity of emptiness to produce things, to be creative. You know, so I throw these out as a way to just to try to like personalize emptiness practice a little bit. Just to give some examples of how it's found purchase in my own life. By the way, the mind, just to finish out this, you know, ignore the mind at all times. Ignore it in the middle of practice when the mind keeps wanting to move awareness back to an object. So if you're doing sky gazing, rest assured that for the first few minutes or maybe hours or whatever, like, the thought will come, go to the fridge, go to the TV, you know, anything but this, you know, looking up at the sky. It'll start to berate you. It'll start to say, it's a waste of time. You need to be doing something productive. You need to be writing a great American novel. You need to be doing your to-do list or whatever it is. Yeah? There's the mind trying to take you away from reality, the dastardly mind. So right in the middle of the practice, first of all, the mind will say, don't do the practice. While you're doing the practice, it will continue to say, don't do it. It will give you many reasons not to do it. And then afterwards, and this is in some ways the most insidious, because I hope by now many of you have recognized, wow, I went to the Grand Canyon, I was doing emptiness practice, or whatever it is for you. Maybe it was the Mississippi River Bluffs or something, you know? But then the mind will also attempt to diminish, deny, forget the actual experience that you had. And therefore, instead of really making something out of it and getting all of its healing potential and creative and energetic potential, the mind will snuff it out by these kind of critical post remarks. So you got to watch that mind and learn how to just let all that critical thinking go and stay with real experience. I certainly want to open this to some comments and questions, so let me just find a nice way to finish up my remarks here. You know, I could refer you to Thich Nhat Hanh if you would like to explore how he teaches emptiness. He's a Zen monk and a Buddhist teacher, a lot of his teachings are about emptiness. And you might have heard him give talks about what he calls interbeing. And this is his way of talking about emptiness. He will say, for example, that, you know, he says when he looks into a sheet of paper, he looks and he really looks into the sheet of paper and he can see the tree that made the paper, and he can see the sunlight that nourished the tree, and he can see the rain that nourished the tree, and he can see the logger that logged the tree, and on and on. And then he will say, notice that the piece of paper, it doesn't really have existence as paper. He says it's made of non-paper elements. Paper is made of non-paper elements. And there's no paperness in the paper, actually. It just, it comes from elsewhere. And he said, this is the same with human beings. If we look to ourself, we see that each one of us is made of non-us elements. I am made of non-me elements. And this is a way of understanding emptiness, getting back to the original definition the Buddha gave. It's empty of self-nature. There's no self to be found. Can you feel how liberating it is to recognize that in our own being? Because most of our suffering comes from understanding ourselves as this limited, independent, fiercely independent, struggling, fearful self that's always locking down, thinking it has to keep the world out because the world is dangerous. But this flips it around and shows the actual reality that every single moment, every cell in our body is interacting with the rest of the universe, you know, through lineage or through gravity or through cosmic rays or whatever it is. It's like there's nothing independent about the body. Half of my lungs are hanging on the tree out there, you know, that kind of thing. So just this is the kind of creative thinking that helps us to stay in emptiness practice. So let me just finish with this nice quote from Thich Nhat Hanh, where he's talking about fathers and sons. Son and father have no separate existence. Son is empty of son, and father is empty of father. Father and son, they inter are. If there is no father, there is no son. If there is no son, there is no father. I know when I read these, I think about my dad, and I think about my relationship with my dad. So then it goes on. So father and son manifest at the same time, like left and right, interbeing. And then Thich Nhat Hanh goes on to say, so those who are so angry with their father, who say, I don't want to have anything to do with that person, nonsense, says Thich Nhat Hanh, because you cannot take your father out of you. You are the continuation of your father. You are your father. You are empty of a separate self. You are made of non-you elements only. This is emptiness practice, the way he does it. And among the non-you elements, there is the father element in it. So if you meditate on emptiness, you see the interconnection, the interbeing of you and father, and you can liberate yourself from anger. Because you are your father. You carry your father everywhere you go. You carry all of your ancestors. You are not a person, a self. You are a lineage. And when you see like that, you see you are full of the cosmos, that you are empty of a separate self. This is a very deep teaching. It removes all kinds of discrimination. It can liberate you. So we have a good 10 minutes here. I'm just wondering what that might have brought up for you, and whether you might have some experiences of emptiness, or like how you have done emptiness practice, or if you have any questions about emptiness practice. Hi, Jean.
Hi.
There's a note here that says, please remind folks that the question and answer period is being recorded. Done.
Okay. Well, the thing about being empty of self, I find it difficult, and I don't want to give up that somewhere, you know, there's me. However, I do appreciate the way you explained it this evening, simply emptiness. And while on the retreat this past week, I had a really nice experience that illustrated this for me. An incident happened where I felt discounted or not paid attention to the way I wanted to be, and I found myself stewing about it. So obviously there was I there who had been mistreated and was upset, and I did some walking practice, and some other thoughts came to mind, like, oh, I contributed to this situation, so it really wasn't so solid of a violation or mistreatment as I had thought. And then pretty soon it just kind of dissipated because, you know, I really don't know the meaning of my behavior and the other person's behavior. You know, was this really a Freudian slip that really meant, you know, something, my behavior and so forth. So, you know, just that dissipation. And I can see that the upsetness and the stewing had to do with hanging on to some concept of this me that didn't want to be discounted or whatever, and very freeing to let go of it. So appreciated experiencing emptiness.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the last time you came to town, too. So I wanted to be here tonight. I'm glad I came. When I first began studying the teachings or the Dhamma, I would say Thich Nhat Hanh's explanation of interbeing was it deeply affected me. It wasn't that hard for me to follow, explained in that way. I think he used the example of a flower, my first encounter with it, and the common sense of it, and it was completely undeniable and above reproach in my head. I looked at it and I thought, well, that's true. You look at a flower, you see soil, you see sun, you see rain. It is comprised of entirely non-flower elements. And I really did sort of internalize it or look at myself and realize that, you know, I've gone through this life, my identity is Lyndon, but I'm comprised of entirely non-Lyndon elements. It really informs my sitting practice too, because I don't have to conceptualize it, but I've heard these wonderful teachings from wonderful teachers, you know, and when I sit and I can settle in, that's kind of the ground of being of my practice. I don't know what my practice would be like had I not been exposed to that, because that's kind of my reality, you know. It's a place where, and it kind of mitigates everything, hard feelings, things like what Jean was talking about. Not that I still have all those emotions, but I have it's like a place, a grounded place to go back to and go, wait a minute, you know. Interbeing is true, you know. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. At the beginning of the talk, you talked about being aware of awareness or focusing on the awareness. Thich Nhat Hanh said that awareness is always aware of something, which brings up the question, is awareness really different than the object of the awareness? Is there a duality there? And if I'm focusing on the awareness and leaving out the object. There's nothing there. Do you see what I'm saying? Do you see the conundrum? That's where I get messed up. Maybe you can help me with that. Well, if you focus on the awareness and not the object of the awareness, there's nothing there. Maybe that's
emptiness.
That's emptiness. Okay.
That's emptiness, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. So, once we get into that realm, you know, it's pretty hard to use language because when awareness is aware of awareness, by the way, you know, Thich Nhat Hanh said awareness is always aware of something. Well, one of the things it can be aware of is awareness. It doesn't just have to be objects. It can be noticing itself. But then again, you continue to explore. Where does every object happen anyway? It happens in awareness. It's an appearance in awareness. So in fact, when we're looking at the body, we're looking at awareness. It's just taking the form of the body right now. You see? And, you know, one of the ways the Buddha taught emptiness meditation was to go in finer and finer and finer and finer degrees. So he has this lovely teaching where it's something like, first you look at the village, and then you look at people in the village, then you look at the earth. And every time you do that, you leave behind distracting elements. Like the village is full of gossip and news and But then one person is like, you just cut out all that stuff and it's just like that person. But every person has a lot of this vibrational agitation. And then you go to the earth. And then you go to space. And then you go to the space of consciousness. And then there are even finer elements than that. And each time you do that, you kind of leave some of the agitation behind. And you actually notice, now each one of those, great, we're still in the realm of objects, it's just subtler and subtler objects. And then you end up just being aware of awareness, you know. And then there's a sense of, well, it was all happening in awareness all along. It's another way to look at it is the famous Buddhist meditation manual, The Four Foundations of Awareness, the body, feelings, thoughts, and dharmas, it is said. What you realize after you practice that enough is that the Buddha is saying, you do awareness of the body long enough until you realize you're actually looking at awareness itself. You're looking at the appearance of the body within consciousness. But when we start off, it's like, that's too abstract. So that's why it's wonderful to start with the body, if you see what I mean. Yeah, I think we've got time for one more. Yeah.
When I'm in a state of emptiness, whether my ideas are unfixed or the distance between a you and a me starts to merge, or it's a state of oneness with the sky that you described. One thing that I feel I notice when I'm empty is flow or movement, the movement of information or sensation or whatever. And the point, as I see it, is what is the source of flow or the receiving of whatever's going on that you're so empty, you're letting it move through you. And I guess my inclination is that when things are empty, when we are empty and things hit our heart, there's love, or there is, as you talk tonight, there's love for the practice. If I erased all the content, I hear the love. I see that. And that somehow as beings in this place of interbeing, if there isn't that, we die. We don't thrive that well. And so I guess my concern with emptiness as a concept is when all emptiness leads to connection and meaning, then emptiness is such a great path. But when emptiness leads to disconnection and kind of like a void, I find there's a trap here because I think.
So let me just address that in a way that kind of wrap up kind of what I was offering tonight. So you're absolutely right. There's two ways we can go. There's two ways that we can go with this. One is to go with how thoughts define emptiness, which is nothingness and void, as you said. It's a nihilistic view. And it is one that the dastardly mind, as I've been calling it tonight, is quite comfortable with and would like us to stay with. And the most important thing to recognize is that this is not our actual experience. This is what the mind is telling us. By the way, when I use the word mind here, I'm talking about thoughts. I'm not talking about the larger consciousness. So the thing to remember is thoughts are telling us something about our experience. And that is one way we can go is to sort of believe, if you will, what thoughts are telling us about our experience, like emptiness. We've come to associate emptiness as the absence of all objects, that life is nothingness, et cetera, et cetera. That is what thoughts are telling us emptiness is. Because thought in itself cannot know ultimate reality. Thought is just one thing that happens within ultimate reality. And yet it has the arrogance to say that it understands reality, can explain reality, and even is reality. This is amazing that there's an aspect of our experiences telling us this, and it's amazing that we believe it enough to keep ourselves in suffering. The point then is that we have the capacity to actually experience life, and this is what this other understanding of emptiness is, that there is an experience of spaciousness, of the Grand Canyon within ourselves, of the openness, and yes, absolutely, this is part two of the talk, which maybe I'll come back and give. We've been talking about love tonight. Love is a synonym for emptiness. And it's what we get when we let go of believing what our thoughts are telling us is our experience. And when we just learn what our actual experience is telling us, we can experience the body as empty, we experience our suffering as empty, and we open to the flow of love. It's been such a pleasure to be with you tonight. And we are at 8:31. So, see you next time.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.